Jay Perini's latest book, Promised Land, is a discourse on 13 books that shaped the thought, culture, and history of the United States. Each of them, from A Plymouth Plantation to The Feminine Mystique, captured and amplified an element of what developed into the American national character. And Mr. Perini's book is published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased it has brought him to this show. Welcome back. And you've been here as a writer of fiction and nonfiction over the years.
Yes.
What got you thinking about this topic?
Well, first let me say it's great to be on your show again. It's been year after year, it seems, I appear here.
Well, you keep on writing interesting books.
Well, let's hope. I was living in London about 3 years ago and for a year, and with my wife and my youngest kid. And one night on a hot summer in Hampstead, my wife said, there's a talk down the street. Lord Malcolm Bragg, great name, is going to be talking about 12 books that changed the world. So she dragged me along, and it was a pretty tedious lecture. But I noticed that they were all English books, you know. There was not one book that changed the world that wasn't an English book, Lord Bragg seemed to think. So I began writing in my program notes, as I often do, because I'm paying no attention to the lecture. And I wondered, what would be the 12 books that changed America? And so I started making my list, and I filled up my program and my wife's program and reached into my pocket and took out more scraps of paper. And when I rushed out of the lecture, I went home, and I found myself unable to sleep. I sat at the kitchen table in our flat in Hampstead making long lists of books saying what would be the books that changed America. Then I began emailing friends, college professors, and just writers and just ordinary people that I know, and said, what do you think would be the books that changed America? And for about 3 or 4 months, I honed this list because I immediately saw what a fun book to write this would be.
Except you didn't want a dozen. You wanted 13 because of the original 13
That's
colonies
right.
that became the states.
Right. What's the number? I thought, well, 13 original colonies. Let's go with 13.
Well, certain books automatically come to mind. I probably would have thought of Uncle Tom's Cabin and Huck Finn immediately, but also Henry Adams, who didn't even make your extended list. So I'm not exactly sure I understand all of this. And also, it's not about literature, so neither Gatsby nor Moby Dick is on the list, even though you're writing a novel about Herman Melville. But On the Road is.
And I also, you know, last April I published a book called Why Poetry Matters. And I've been writing, my main work is as a poet every morning. I work on poems. And friends have said, you didn't include one volume of poetry.
Walt Whitman.
I know. Why not Leaves of Grass? And if I had chosen to write a book on the 13 greatest American books, Leaves of Grass, Moby Dick, and The Great Gatsby would be there. But I wanted to write about, I was trying to really take an X-ray of American culture. Remember, this was 3 years ago. Bush had just been elected for the second time. I was pretty despairing about our country. I thought, you know, I would like to just stay in England for the rest of my life. I don't even want to go back to that damn place. I felt depressed about America.
Even though the British believed that every important book written was written by a Brit?
Well, that's another subject altogether, the British xenophobia.
It was okay because you were an outsider.
I was an outsider.
You could be amused by that.
I just took it with a grain of salt, and I love the British, and I just sat back and laughed. But I began thinking, you know, let's just start rereading some of these amazing American books. And so I chose my 13 books. I actually limited, I had 20 books I was starting off with. And I began rereading these books, and I suddenly began to realize I was once an incredibly hopeful American. I grew up from an immigrant family. You know, my family were Italian immigrants. My grandparents came in steerage on a ship, and my grandmother used to say people were thrown overboard when they died. My grandparents were extremely poor, and my father was, you know, uneducated. My mother was uneducated. And I pulled myself up in the traditional way by the bootstraps, and it was the American educational system which rescued me. And here I've become a professor at, you know, Dartmouth and Middlebury and Oxford, and I've written, you know, 25, 30 books, and I've had a real life. And I owe it to this country. It's a great country. And I, somewhere in the course of the Bush years, lost my optimism, my hope for America. And going back to these books, I realized, wait a minute, this was a bold and exciting experiment, this American Republic.
Interestingly, you limited it to Americans, considering what happened with that Brit. Tocqueville doesn't wind up making the list either.
Right.
But as an academic, did you assume that you knew all of the contenders?
Well, I cast around among many, many, many friends. And so I didn't think I would just in my own head know what would be the contenders. And I also say, you know, I have an appendix, as you know, to the book, 100 more books that changed America. And in fact, that was whittled down from roughly 200 books that changed America. And so I was really looking not for books like Henry Adams, which intellectuals adore, but I was looking for books that somehow are give an X-ray into the American soul and character. I mean, I really do believe that this book, Promised Land, somehow gets at the DNA of the American psyche, that I'm looking at who is the American character through the lens of these 13 texts.
So impact was the key factor for you.
And also I say not one of these books stands alone. Each of them is a climate of opinion.
And how important are they to be read today? Are they still readable, or are they something that are they often just important in their time and have an impact for a while, and then we see the result from then on?
Most of these books can, and not only can, should be reread by every single American. I just don't think it. I think in this moment when we have immense hope in President Obama, we see a whole new landscape of American life opening up before us. There never could be a better time than to go back and reread the Federalist Papers, things like that.
Well, whenever anyone makes any kind of list, someone is always going to be unhappy with
Absolutely.
It. And have you already been getting that kind of feedback?
You know, I was shocked. One reviewer said, how could he have left off The Great Gatsby, even from the 100 books that shaped America?
And that included Jane Fonda's Workout.
Right. My 100 list includes Jane Fonda's Workout book and the Surgeon General's report on smoking, and no Great Gatsby. And let me just tell everybody listening, that was simply an error. I almost chose it as one of my 13 books to write about, and it would have been the 14th book, and I somehow forgot to put it on the list.
Jay Barini is here with, well, that's always a problem when you're coming up with lists, but in the end, the list is a fascinating list, and I like to talk about some of the books on it.
Sure.
Jay Barini's book is Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. It's published by Doubleday. The oldest one is A Plymouth Plantation. When was it written?
Well, it was Governor William Bradford came on the Mayflower, 1620, and for 27 years wrote his diary as he was governor. And it is one of the great American texts. It tells the story of the first Thanksgiving, the story of the pilgrims getting along, making it through the harsh first winter with the help of the Wampanoag Indians. The book was lost for 3 centuries, and the manuscript was rediscovered just before the Civil War.
Had it been published in the 1640s or so?
It was only written in handwriting, and the manuscript was lost.
And you suggest that this is the book that created the holiday of Thanksgiving, among other things.
Abraham Lincoln stumbled upon the book in 1863, thought it was a remarkable story of American can-do enterprise, getting along, building community, and he was inspired at the peak of the Civil War by this book and declared the date in November a holiday.
But can we trust much of what we get in this book? How much of it is mythology, as you suggest?
Well, it's a myth-making book in the sense it's in the story of the pilgrims, founding fathers, Thanksgiving has entered. It's one of every nation has its own founding stories. The Romans have Romulus and Remus, you know, every nation. And we can pretty much trust the story because Governor Bradford was there. He was running the damn thing. He was the governor of the colony, and he has the advantage of being a participant in history as well as a recorder.
You mentioned the Federalist Papers, and I hadn't remembered that it actually had been published anonymously.
Well, it was published under the name Publius, after a great Roman Republican. And it was really written, as you know, by Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison.
And why didn't they want to put their names to it?
Well, I think they wanted to create a composite character. And it was very common in those days to write articles in newspapers under a pseudonym. And so that's what why they chose this.
Were they also afraid that some of these things might open up all sorts of cans of worms?
Well, it's true. You know, in many ways, Hamilton and Madison especially often go against their own grain, the things they were actually arguing when they were present at the 1887 Philadelphia Constitutional Convention. So we see, in fact, a Hamiltonian Madison emerging and a Madisonian Hamilton. And so it's wonderful how if you're no longer writing as Lenny Lopate, you can suddenly become somebody else.
I do that sometimes when I'm on the air. Become the other Leonard Lopate. In the Federalist Papers, Hamilton argues against term limits. Do you think that Maya Bloomberg has read that part of the book?
Well, the reason he argued against term limits was, he said, think of the specter of these old ghosts, former presidents, wandering around, furious that they've been tossed out of office. Think of all the mischief they could cause.
Well, it didn't work out that way, although some of them would have liked to have caused some mischief.
You know, you think of Jimmy Carter, we've had, and Bill Clinton, we've actually been blessed by very wonderful ex-presidents.
And people are still arguing over whether term limits are a good idea or not. Presidents are limited now to 2 terms, although I don't think there were people who were complaining during FDR's years that he was one step away from being a king.
Well, the fun thing is, going back to the Federalist Papers, you read these 85 essays on aspects of American government, and you realize how much of it was up for grabs. And there was a big argument on all these subjects going on. There were the anti-federalists, Federal Farmer, James Mason, people who really disliked the Constitution of the United States.
Ben Franklin's autobiography is here. Did he really invent the autobiography? Hadn't other people written about their lives?
Only famous people wrote about their lives. Before Ben Franklin, you had either saints' lives or the memoirs of great statesmen or kings or something like that, a royalty. Ben Franklin really invents the modern form of autobiography, which is the story of how I, a poor boy or poor girl from nowhere, invented myself. It's a book about the invention of self.
And like so much memoir and autobiography, it's also an invention.
Well, you know, yes, I think one of the great forms of fiction is autobiography.
So how close do you think the Franklin in that book is to the real man?
Well, we'll never know. I don't think we have enough information about what Ben Franklin was really like, in quotes. But he certainly created a mythic figure, this poor boy from a leather apron family in Boston who stows away and comes into Philadelphia with 3 bread loaves rolled under his arm, walks up Market Street, waves to a girl in the doorway, and that happens to be the person who becomes his wife, sets himself up with this guy Keimer as a printer, and before long he owns the printing shop. He owns the biggest newspaper in the colonies. He's Rupert Murdoch of the 13 colonies.
A workaholic. And John Adams, on the other hand, when he joined Franklin in Paris during the Revolutionary War, thought that Franklin was lazy.
Well, that's right. And he also didn't like the fact that when he went to Paris to work with Franklin, that Franklin was going out to dinner every night, staying out till midnight, drinking crates of French wine.
Well, he was in Paris. What else do you do?
That's right. Young, beautiful young French girls dandled on his knee. He thought, what a old reprobate.
This also is the first self-help book, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Franklin invented the self-help book. I mean, we're all familiar with How to Get Ahead in Life, that kind of a book. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I think we could trace, as I do, in fact, Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, back to the autobiography of Ben Franklin.
And you include that book as well.
Well, I think one of my most controversial, perhaps crazy choices of the 13 books that changed America was Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. But over and again, people come up to me and say, hey, that's a book that changed my life. I was a very shy teenager in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and I had no friends and didn't know how to get along in the world. And I discovered this book in the Scranton Globe Store book section, bought it, came home, read it cover to cover, and he suggests keeping a journal and systematically going about trying to make friends. He said, for example, if you praise something in somebody, they're going to like it. If I were to say, Lenny, you have the most wonderfully trimmed beard, I wish I had a beard like that, you would be my friend for life. Well, I sat in my class and I wrote down everybody's name in a notebook. And Joe, I remember writing Joe. He was a great football player on the junior high team. He could throw passes, and marvelous everybody marvel at his arm, throwing arm. So one day after class, I said, Joe, I said, I just want to tell you, I've never seen anybody throw passes like that before. There was one girl in the class who, was rather large and isolated, and no one talked to her. And I walked, studied her for 3 days, and suddenly realized when we were in Spanish class, whenever she pronounced the word burro, she rolled that R. And I said to her after class one day, I said, Susie, you really speak, Spanish almost like, a Spaniard. I could have got married that day to her. She was a friend for life.
Do you think people still read Dale Carnegie, or do they not care whether that girl in their Spanish class can roll her R's?
Well, I think the publishers would tell you that tens of millions have bought How to Win Friends and Influence People over the years. In fact, I quoted an interesting statistic in that book. Since Perestroika, 1989, in Russia, since the Soviet Union became Russia, it's gone through something like 19 editions in Russian alone. This book appeals to people, but I also say this book set in motion a line of self-help books, and I trace the lineage from How to Win Friends and Influence People to books like Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, or The Purpose-Driven Life, or some of these works of Joel Osteen.
The journals of Lewis and Clark make it, and it's obvious why they did. They really did inspire people to go west.
And really, they opened up the entire country. People read the journals of Lewis and Clark in the early 19th century, and they said, let's go. And so, and then they got in their canoes, and they got on their Canastogan wagons and horseback and hiking, and they went west. This was, as Robert Frost once wrote, a nation gradually realizing westward.
Well, Lewis and Clark's journey represented the American journey outward, and an encounter with the other. Is Walden the opposite, the journey inward?
Yes, Walden is probably my favorite book. I never read Walden without feeling spiritually refreshed. He takes us back to Walden Pond, and the pond becomes a metaphor for the mind. And we reach deep into the mind, and we're utterly transported. I loved writing on this book, Walden, and it is the inward journey as opposed to the outward journey.
Three of the books deal with race in different ways. Mm-hmm. There's Uncle Tom's Cabin, there's Huckleberry Finn, and there's W.E.B. Du Bois's key book on race as well. The book which said that race would be the American problem for the 20th century. Mm. I guess it could be said for the 21st century as well.
Well, certainly you couldn't write a book that's trying to x-ray the American psyche without making race primary. That's why three of my books deal with race. You quote W.B. Du Bois there, and he said that the problem of the 20th century is the color line. And when we look at our history of racism going back to slavery, this is a country which has had a deep agony over the issue of race. And the election of President Obama gives me such hope, because we're finally coming to a point in our history where we can begin to deal with race in a very open way.
Although there are people who are saying that maybe we're putting too much weight on this election. I asked Toni Morrison if this is a turning point, and she said, you have to ask white folks that, not me. Mm-hmm. Jane Smiley created a stir when she chose Uncle Tom's Cabin over Huckleberry Finn as the great American novel.
Well, that's just nutty. there's no comparison between Huckleberry Finn and Uncle Tom's Cabin as works of art. Nevertheless, Uncle Tom's Cabin was more influential in its day, and also it is a brilliant book. I was stunned. Frankly, I had never read it before. It's the only one of the 13 books that I had to read from scratch. And I thought, this will be a chore, so I started one Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, and I found myself unable to leave my chair until midnight. I read it from first page to last page.
So did Harriet Beecher Stowe invent the page-turner?
Well, she was Stephen King on steroids.
Another book here, and I'm not surprised, although I probably wouldn't have put it in a list if you'd asked me, is Benjamin Spock's Baby and Child Care. That really did change the way Americans raise their children.
Before Dr. Spock, the whole idea was that, you had basically preachers writing books on how to raise children. And the basic message was, shame the hell out of them. And Dr. Spock came along, a scientist, a humane fellow, a kind of guru, I think. And the first line of that book is so inspiring. It's been through endless editions. But I remember when my first child, Will, was born in 1982, a friend gave me and my wife that book. And I read the first line, and I was so moved. You know more than you think you know. And he asks parents to trust their own instincts and intelligence.
Although there are people who will claim that he's responsible for generations of ever more permissive and indulgent parents and spoiled children and everything terrible that came after.
But that's nonsense, because there's really nothing in Dr. Spock's handbook for parents that suggests that you should be permissive or let the kids do anything they want. In fact, far from that. He's a pretty stern taskmaster. It was only because Dr. Spock supported the anti-war protesters during the Vietnam War that people like Spiro Agnew came on the TV and said, these younger people, it's all Dr. Spock's fault, the permissive generation.
You include The Feminine Mystique, Betty Friedan's book. She wasn't the first writer to write a book making those claims. There was a famous French writer who had done pretty well.
Well, The Feminist Mystique, Betty Friedan, I think of as Simone de Beauvoir light. But she was...
made Simone de Beauvoir more accessible?
Well, that's it. I mean, sure, the average person wasn't going to read Simone de Beauvoir and extrapolate all the ideas from it. Essentially, I mean, Betty Friedan was a journalist, and she put in a very accessible form the key ideas of feminism, which are really remarkable and transforming. And she was one of the first people to say, look, this is not just about transforming women, it's about transforming men. This will change and improve families.
And later there were women in the feminist movement who rejected Betty Friedan as being much too moderate.
Right. I mean, Betty Friedan was the leader of what's called the second wave of feminism. Now, we're now into what's called the third wave, and it's a very complex post-structural wave. And, they look back at Betty Friedan as an old, dinosaur.
The only book we haven't talked about is The Promised Land. That's about the immigrant experience.
Yeah. I'd written the other 12 chapters, and I thought, what's missing from my 13th book? And I realized this is a nation of immigrants. We're all immigrants, even if we're from a WASP family. It's a fairly recent heritage, right? Even the people called things like, Smith came here from England in the 17th century, probably, or even 16th century. And so my favorite immigrant memoir was Promised Land by Mary Anton. She was a Jewish girl from the Pale of Settlement in what was somewhere between Russia and Poland. And she envisioned this promised land where the streets were paved with gold. And she went on this ship like so many immigrants did, like my grandparents did, in steerage. People were thrown overboard into the sea and buried. And she arrived in America, and, of course, it was not what it was cracked up to be. But eventually, the educational system, the libraries, the community lifted her up. And this is a very wonderful, hopeful book.
And you borrowed her title. You just took the off of it.
That's it. I just swiped her title. Titles are free.
You can write a book called War and Peace.
In fact, Tolstoy stole that book. There was a French novel that had just come out called War and Peace.
So now that you've taken care of this, are you back to the poetry and the fiction?
I never leave the poetry. For 40 years now, I begin every day of my life sitting in a cafe with a cup of coffee, my notebook open, and usually a book of poems at the side, and I read and write poetry. So that's my sort of daily spiritual practice.
Is that just something like an exercise, or is that something that you really feel produces important work for you?
No, for me, it's the core of my writing life, and I feel like all of my fiction and nonfiction comes out of the poetry work that I do. And, once every 5 or 6 years, I go over my notebooks, and I cull out 50, 60 pages of it and publish a collection.
And also you're writing a novel, you said.
I'm writing a novel now about the life of the man who wrote Moby Dick, Herman Melville, and I'm having a great time with that.
Didn't even make it into this book.
Didn't even make it into the 13 books. I should also know, my book, The Last Station, I once came on here and talked about it 20 years ago, has just been made into a film starring Helen Mirren, Christopher Plummer, James McAvoy, and Paul Giamatti. So that'll be coming out soon.
And some of the other novels include The Apprentice Lover, Benjamin's Crossing. There are biographies of John Steinbeck, Robert Frost, and William Faulkner. Also a book on the art of teaching and why poetry matters. Mm-hmm. Which, we've discussed any number of those on this show over the years. This book is Promised Land, 13 Books That Changed America. It's published by Doubleday. And you can see Jay Perini. He'll be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. That's, what is that? That's 16th Street, is it? The north of Union Square?
North of Union Square, yes. And I hope people come out to it. It's going to be a fun evening.
And that is, I'm told, what... Did I say 7 o'clock? 17th Street.
It's 7 o'clock tonight.
7 o'clock on 17th Street. Yeah, well, get it right. Meanwhile, Jay, thank you so much for coming by and talking about Promised Land with us.
Thank you very much, Lenny.